You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
This is Spingola Speaks, and this is Deanna Spingola. I'm coming to you from the office in the suburbs of Chicago. Thanks for joining me today in RBN Studio B. Today is the last day that I will be in Studio B because RBN is eliminating Studio B. Starting on Monday, October 22nd, I will be back in Studio A beginning at 11 a.m. Central Time. The program will be 1 hour long until the end of November. RBN has assured me that we will then return to the 2-hour format. RBN is conducting a pledge drive. If you wish to contribute, you may do so at the RBN website at republicbroadcasting.org. Please visit spingola.com to see the guest lineup for this program along with relevant links spingola.com. During the program, email your questions or comments to spingola1@yahoo.com. My regular email is deanna@spingola.com. Join others in the chat room by clicking on the chat room button on my website or by going to spingola.chatango.com. We will take calls in the second hour after we open the phone lines at 877-488-5350. I would like to tell you a brief story about Emily, a 14-year-old young woman who lives in a European country who has had some very interesting conversations with her father regarding accurate history as opposed to the official version. Her literature teacher, who avidly promotes Holocaustianity in the classroom, assigned each of the students to write and give a presentation about the Nazis. Her father wrote and told me about how his daughter handled this very questionable assignment. First, she told the class that she refused to use the term Nazi, as it is a very pejorative term that the members of the NSDAP never used. The Allies, the winners who continued to write the history of World War II, devised that term. Emily, this courageous young woman, told her fellow students about how international Jewry declared an economic war against Germany in the spring of 1933. Emily explained how the Germans from every economic class joined the NSDAP because of its views on the Bolsheviks. Emily also pointed out that most of the leading Bolsheviks were Jewish and that they had targeted Germany and planned to impose communism there. She told her fellow students about the inequities of the Versailles Treaty and told how the winners of World War I just divvied up Germany, which placed ethnic Germans under the jurisdiction of longtime enemies. Emily talked about the Allied firebombing of innocent Germans, civilians, in non-military target cities. At the end of her presentation, she perceived that she had aroused the curiosity of many of the students. Meanwhile, her teacher was rather upset, if not downright angry. Emily tried to give her teacher a copy of Benjamin Friedman's 1961 speech, but her close-minded teacher refused to accept it. On Wednesday, Colin Gunn and I were talking about the herd mentality of the majority of students. We mentioned that students were afraid to go against the grain, were afraid to raise controversial issues or counter what their teachers were attempting to indoctrinate them with. It is so refreshing to hear about Emily, a young woman with the courage of her convictions, the integrity, and the boldness to speak the truth to a group of people who had probably not had the opportunity to hear another viewpoint. What a courageous thing to do. If only more adults were as well informed and as bold as Emily. Bless you, Emily. We'll be right back in 3 minutes. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Rodney Martin. He is the director of Worldview Foundations. His website is wvfoundations.org. Welcome to the program, Rodney.
Well, good morning, Deanna, and thank you for having me on. I want to apologize for our having to reschedule from earlier in the week to today, every once in a while we get hit with some of these little family snafus that we have to take care of. But I appreciate your flexibility to let me come on this morning. Can I start off just by commenting on that wonderful example you mentioned with the young student Emily? I think there's more of that happening than we realize. And I've often said, in fact, I've written about it, that where we're going to win this, and the truth lies with grandparents and grandchildren. The middle generation is lost. They allow themselves to be brainwashed and to be uncomfortable with, confronting the plethora, the volumes of lies. But the younger people, I think that's coming our way for a whole host of reasons. The younger people are getting to be more skeptical of these tall tales that just, are just fall on the weight of fact. And young people tend to, study and say, well, I'm going to check into that. And when they do, it just doesn't add up. And they tend to be, a lot more confrontational, and they do not want to be spoon-fed, or they do not want to be told what to think. And I use the example of the survey that was done. I think I mentioned this on your program before. There was a survey done of young, I believe it was middle school. It would be equivalent to middle school and high school students in Germany and college-bound students in Germany. And the simple question was Adolf Hitler a dictator? And a majority of the respondents of young people said they couldn't say that he was, based on the facts and based on what they had learned. And it sent shockwaves into the middle generation, the PC generation, and the German vassal state. And their conclusion was, we need more, these students need more education, which is another word for indoctrination. So I think that the tide is really, really, moving our way. And of course, I think the results of that survey is basically the results of the hard work of those revisionist historians and truth tellers who have sacrificed so much, gone to jail, lost their homes, have gone into exile, and I think ultimately their sacrifices will pay off, and that's why we're seeing these European nations that are still in power just getting more and more shrill, where they'll put people in jail for, whistling a forbidden song, which is just ludicrous. And when you do things like that, when you tell younger people that you cannot even read a book, you can't obtain a book, you cannot sing a song, have a record, have a CD, can't think a certain way, that just sparks more curiosity and to research and to get on the internet and to go to verboten sites and to say, why not? And then pretty soon they learn themselves that everything that they're being told to think is absolutely hogwash. And so we need more Emilys, and we need a lot more Emilys. And she is she's a hallmark in courage, and we need more of her.
Indeed, indeed. And her father said, she has the courage that it takes to present different ideas. And she has really seen the effects of brainwashing. And I think anybody would be proud of a daughter like that.
Well, there's an example. She was assigned to write a paper. So she went mm-hmm. and researched. She wrote a paper, cited her sources, and even presented one of her sources to her teacher, a teacher who is supposed to be promoting intellectual honesty and intellectual freedom, whether that teacher, I don't know if it was a male or a female, accepts or agrees, has a personal opinion, should read it. And, but there's a prime example. And she learned, and I think probably that teacher, by their own closed-mindedness and attempted of indoctrination and refusing to even read the source, did more to reaffirm Emily's research than anything.
Oh, absolutely. And what did this do for the rest of the students? I mean, it made them wonder. And sure that many of those will go to the internet and will go to those same sources and will talk to Emily, and this thing is going to grow.
Oh, absolutely. I'm tickled pink by this, because it reaffirms, the study that was done in Germany and some of the other trends that are trending elsewhere. I firmly believe that what we do, and that's one of the reasons why I'm doing what we're doing with the oral histories and such, to have that archive of oral history so students like Emily can go there and hear the stories from those that lived it, and so they would have more authoritative sources to do their research on as well. as we move forward. I really believe that the tide is trending our way, and so especially like to the topic of today's program, you know, the true origins of World War II. As I did the recent oral history up in the Pacific Northwest, originally, Deanna, I was originally not even going to mention Poland per se, because the World War II really had, you know, the true origins had really little to do with Poland. But after doing that, you know, 2.5 hour oral history, I decided, well, yeah, we really do need to mention Poland, because even if, you know, World War II had something to do with Poland, the German action, and that was what it was a limited action in Poland, the German action was correct. The German government's action into Poland was absolutely correct. It was moral. And there's been a whole lot of other precedent by other nations, even those nations that waged war on Germany because of their action on Poland. They had done similar things to protect their interests, you know, launching preemptive actions as well. So I actually retooled what I wanted to talk about to include, okay, we're going to talk about Poland as well before we go on and talk about, you know, the real origins. And I really hope we have a lot of calls, because this is a topic, Deanna, that you really have to take a lot of calls, because there's been so many lies about why World War II began. Oh, Hitler invaded Poland because he wanted to conquer the world. Ah, wrong. World War II began because Britain and France was protecting Poland's territorial integrity. Wrong. You know, that's false. It's just a false front for much broader issues. But if we can just talk for a little bit, let's talk about Poland and get that out of the way. There were issues, there were legitimate issues with Poland, but those were issues that the German government, when the National Socialists came to power as part of a coalition government in 1933, and as a matter of fact, the first German foreign minister in the National Socialist Coalition was not a National Socialist. It was von Neurath who was insisted by President von Hindenburg that he remain as foreign minister and reported to President von Hindenburg. So essentially, you know, he coordinated with the chancellor, who was Hitler, was a National Socialist, but von Neurath was not a National Socialist. But one of the first foreign policy actions in 1934, major one, was to make an agreement with Poland and to start addressing the Polish issues. And going back on this Polish issue, if you go back to what we talked about on the last show, you know, the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk had settled all the Eastern issues. And, of course, Versailles, the Allies decided to scrap and void the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, which really they had no business doing. The Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, which took Russia out of the war and created an independent Ukraine, Poland got their, came into existence as a sidebar of that treaty. The Baltic states came into existence as part of the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. The treaty, what all is said and done, is a peace treaty with Russia. The Treaty of Brest-Litovsk was far superior and a lot better off for the Eastern nations than the Treaty of Versailles. Because what did Versailles do? It put Ukraine back under the boot of the Soviet Union, which the Ukraine, you know, ask the Ukrainians, who were, you know, 11, 12 million of them were starved to death in 1936-37 by the Soviets. Do you think, you know, would they have preferred the Treaty of Versailles to go under the boot of the Soviet Union, or would they have preferred to remain independent under the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk? The Baltic states, you really think that they would have preferred, you know, just the guarantees of the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk as opposed to Versailles, where they basically were left with virtually no protections, and then eventually went under the boot of the Soviets, and then were liberated by the Germans for a period of about four and a half years. But, you know, Versailles, this goes back again to the awful way in which the Germans were, it was baited and switched. The Germans entered peace negotiations in World War I under Wilson's 14 points, and they got to the peace negotiations in Compiègne. They were lied to, and they were said, never mind, we're not going to do that. You're basically signing an unconditional surrender document. And that's essentially what Versailles was. And that's why fast forward to 1945, the Germans said, we're just going to fight to the end. And they resisted unconditional surrender till the very end, when it was basically just, there was nothing left, they couldn't do anything else. So getting back to Poland, as early as 1934, and there's diplomatic cables to address this, the Germans and the Polish government under Marshal Pilsudski, they were actually working this out themselves. They were working out the issue with this Polish corridor where the former Prussian province of West Prussia, you know, Posen, had been taken away from Germany and given to Poland unjustly. There was no Polish historical, cultural, or territorial claim on the provinces of West Prussia. There was no Polish territorial cultural claim on the German city of Danzig to split East Prussia from Pomerania. That was absolutely silly. There was no territorial claim there. As a matter of fact, there was indeed a small Polish minority in Danzig, but it was about 5%, if that. Danzig was about 95 to even 98% German, and I think it was November 11th. We'll pick this up on the other side.
All righty. Be right back in 3 minutes. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Rodney Martin. His website is wvfoundations.org. And I would like to call your attention to a remarkable film. It's linked on today's date at my radio schedule page, and it is entitled Adolf Hitler's Struggle for Peace. Fabulous, fabulous movie made by a remarkable person. I hope that you will watch the entire thing. Okay, Rodney, please continue.
Yeah. And I just wanted to go back to this issue. And again, we're covering Poland because the big, you know, what you hear in all the textbooks and all of the agenda historians is World War II started on September 1st, 1939 as a result of the German invasion of Poland, and France and Great Britain had guaranteed Poland's freedom. That's, you even hear that sometimes. Well, anyway, we were speaking about, you know, Danzig, and that Danzig was about a 98% German city. In fact, it was originally part of West Prussia that had been taken away under the Treaty of Versailles, and that Poland had no territorial, cultural claim. As a matter of fact, in 1937, on what was called Polish Independence Day, which they celebrated on November 11th, there's a German diplomatic cable in which a German representative in Danzig had talked about, and again, Danzig did have a small, it was maybe 2 or 3% Polish population, and Danzig, under the Treaty of Versailles, was made a free city under the League of Nations administration, which was kind of odd. It would be like the UN running something. Well, anyway, Poland had a representative to the Polish minority, the 2% Polish minority or 3% in Danzig. And during that celebration, the Polish representative conceded that Poland had no claim to Danzig, because in his remarks on that Independence Day had mentioned that, you know, he yearned for the day in which the Poles and Danzig would relocate or would leave Danzig and settle on Polish territory. And of course, the German representative in Danzig, you know, wired this comment to the Foreign Office and said, you know, this is interesting because since 1937 that this event had taken place and that this comment had been wired to the German Foreign Office. And of course, these diplomatic cables, are all available. They're in the archives. These survived the war. And, I like to use original archive sources because students like Emily can cite these are original sources. This isn't somebody making something up. These are documented sources, and they're probably still available in the Polish archives in Warsaw. Are available. So anyway, these were being documented because since 1934, Germany had signed a treaty, and part of that treaty with Poland was to work out these territorial issues, and Marshal Pilsudski was in agreement with working these out, and part of the arrangement, part of the issues that were raised was the treatment of Germans, the former West Prussians, part of Upper Silesia, which the Poles had tried to grab as well, that was a concern. The problem is, and you see this all through these diplomatic cables going back and forth, you see all of these exchanges between Berlin and Warsaw officially, you know, between the Berlin officials and the Warsaw officials, and then, you know, cables between the embassy in Warsaw and the office in Danzig, because Danzig was a free city. That was administered by the League of Nations, the German officials in Danzig back to Berlin, and even some of the Polish officials from back, is the Marcel Pendolski really had no, he was aged, he was not well, and of course everybody, the Poles were running rampant, and you never hear about the atrocities against the Germans that were taking place. And they were documented, there are photographs, but you never hear this. I'm sure that Emily's teacher, I'm going to talk about, I'm going to use Emily as an example because she's a perfect example, and her teacher's a perfect example of fact versus fiction. Her teacher is the fiction that has become the mainstream history, and Emily's research paper is the fact that nobody will talk about, but it's happening. It is happening. It is moving into Emily's position and her paper, her truth, real history is moving into the mainstream. So essentially, the atrocities that were taking place against the German population in the former West Prussia is not spoken about. You hear it in some of these books, specifically by two authors, Richard Overy and Evans, UK authors. They'll mention it in passing, German allegations of atrocities. Allegations, they were fact. They were documented. They were fact. They were reported on in the French media. They were reported on in the British media. They were even reported, you know, they were even brought up by the Soviets. The Soviets of all who were even saying, no, this is kind of bad. And believe, there was no love lost between the Poles and the Soviets. As a matter of fact, Poland wanted to resolve the issues with Germany because they were deathly afraid of the Soviets, the Russians. They had old Polish saying, believe it or not. The Poles used to say, with the Germans we may lose our freedom, with the Russians we'll lose our soul. They really wanted to resolve, at least early on. But something happened. They signed this agreement with the Germans, with Berlin in 1934. They signed this 10-year treaty, and in that there was specific language to work out, to work towards settling all of these issues. But by 1937, something happened. You see it in these diplomatic tables. You see the ambassador from Poland, and we'll bring this up on the other end, because 1937 is a critical time.
All righty. We'll be right back in 3 minutes. Stay tuned. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Rodney Martin. He is the director of Worldview Foundations, and that website is wvfoundations.org. So please continue.
As I said before the break, if you look in the archives and you look at the diplomatic cables, you see 37, you start seeing intrigue. And you see a lot of interference into the internal affairs and a lot of tinkering between the Polish issue, between Germany and Poland and such. It's interesting, in May of 35, Marshal Pendolski had died. And Poland went through a series of, you know, interim and such presidents and such. But anyway, there's a bunch of concern going on because the Polish press starts ratcheting up anti-German sentiment. And there is discussion between Germany and Poland. Of course, in the meantime, the German economy is booming. Germany had completely emerged, you know, by 36, 37. Germany has emerged from, you know, being absolutely destitute. It's rapidly emerging as a world power. The Soviets are taking note. Britain and France are taking note. The United States is taking note. They've developed this. And we've talked about this in prior shows. And we talked about, we touch on this, that World War II essentially was driven by economics. Germany was developing this new economic system in which middleman Judeo bankers were completely excluded and became fundamentally self-sufficient. And it eventually was developing, you know, this broader plan to where other nations were taking note. And matter of fact, you know, Churchill had that famous quote, you know, Germany had to be crushed because it, you know, it shielded its market, you know, to international banking trade. And we'll get to that a little bit later. Well, anyway, you know, mid to late 37, there was a noted concern. As a matter of fact, the ambassadors discussed this. The German foreign minister and the Polish foreign minister discussed it. What is happening is there seems to be an upsurge on anti-German sentiment in the Polish media, while that is not happening in the German media. As a matter of fact, the German foreign minister had noted to this Polish counterpart, we've actually told the German media to knock off the anti-Polish, any anti-Polish media
Rodney?
Editorials and such. Yes.
Who was controlling the media in Poland at that time? I think that's a very important factor here.
Well, it was interesting because Poland was going through all of this internal turmoil, and actually the Polish government held a lot of control over the Polish media. You'd have the Polish Foreign Office having the Polish media exert all of this, a lot of influence over the Polish media, issuing anti-German editorials, whipping up anti-German stories. Essentially the Polish government, but the Polish government there was a lot of external influences then at that point, a lot of jockeying for control, and actually Poland was actually being run by Jews at that time. Poland became...
Exactly.
Poland was, the media was controlled by Jews and the government. Essentially Poland, after Podolski, became a model, another example of Weimar Germany, you can make the case.
Yes.
And so it's fascinating because from the death of Podolski, you see, let me back up just a little bit. You see, a lot of, very kind descriptions of Marshal Podolski and the attempt to move the German, Polish issues and to resolve them, prior to his death in the diplomatic cables and the exchanges. And it needs to be noted, we need to pause right here, is the German government, contrary to Emily's teacher's perspective, did not use war as an aims to resolve its issues. If you look at the Anschluss with Austria, which was attempted before the National Socialists even came to power, Austria wanted to join with Germany after World War I, and it was prohibited. You know, the hallmark of Wilson's 14 points was every nation's self-determination. Well, Austria, when the Austro-Hungarian Empire was broken up, German Austria said, you know, really, we should be a province of Germany. We're 100% German speaking. We need to be a province of Germany. And they were denied their self-determination. That was how many years before the National Socialists came to power? Essentially, the National Socialists granted Austrian self-determination, and they did it without firing a shot. It was done by the will of the people. And by the way, there's two oral histories now that are posted on my website by Germans who were there living at the time, and they have both attested to the fact that a good 98% of the people supported Anschluss and supported it, by their votes as well. So, you know, all of this hogwash by, you know, people that are writing books who didn't live in the time is countered by people who did live in the time and will tell you that it was supported by the people. And getting back to the diplomatic, Germany went out of their way to resolve the wrongs that had been imposed upon them by Versailles diplomatically. You know, the Sudetenland issue, that was resolved diplomatically at the Munich conference. Britain and France agreed that this German-speaking province of Sudetenland should have been part of Germany after World War I. They agreed with that. They signed an international agreement, which they broke in 1945 and said, oh, never mind, we're going to avoid that one, and then which resulted in the ethnic cleansing and genocide of Germans in the Sudetenland. The occupation of Bohemia and Moravia, that was not done by aggression. You know, the Czechoslovakian government, by international agreement, invited German occupation, and under the concept of self-determination, Slovakia got their independence, which they always wanted, which they got again in 1991 when the Soviet boot was off of their head, forcing their integration with the Czech Republic. So, you know, history eventually proved that the German diplomatic policies and their overall European vision was correct, because the map of Europe today, with the exception of the land stolen from the eastern part of Germany, pretty much resembles what the German policies were looking like back then as well. So I wanted to correct the record here. Germany went out of their way diplomatically. The diplomatic cables all bear that out. Some, you know, they're posted on my website. Some of them are as well. And thank you for the white book, by the way. And they're all there, the original documents.
Yes, absolutely.
You can see the exchanges. Now, what happens in 37 is you have this political vacuum that's taking place in the Polish government, and of course, you know, the international Jewish system is just running havoc in Poland at the time. The media is whipping up anti-German hysteria, and you see a trend of German atrocity, anti-German atrocities committed by Poles. Now, there you'll see some documentaries on the History Channel, and this is kind of interesting. The History Channel goes out and they interview old Polish peasants and farmers that had they say that they were brutalized under the German occupation. And they'll say, I don't understand what went on. When, you know, before the war, we lived in peace and harmony with the German minority. Hogwash. It's absolute hogwash. There were editorials written in Paris, in London, in the Soviet Union, and in other European capitals about what was happening, what the Poles were doing against the Germans. They were calling upon the Poles to stop it, and nothing ever happened.
Doesn't Sumner Redstone own the History Channel or control the History Channel?
That's a subsidiary. It's a subsidiary.
Oh gosh, I wonder why they're telling lies.
Yes, Sumner Redstone is Jewish. He owns Viacom, and Viacom owns the History Channel. So you're going to get a good dose of indoctrination in both arms if you watch that garbage. And so again, you know, by just giving that as an example, is they interview the little Pole peasant in the field, and but they never interview any of the former inhabitants of West Prussia who, you know, sitting in their home one morning having breakfast, and the Polish hit squads come in and, you know, drag the husband out and shoot him in the head and leave them in the doorstep, and then rape the women and children, and then burn the house down, and then go on and go on and go on and go on. And that was well documented, not just in German reports, but it was documented in the rest of the European media, and they were calling on it to be resolved. And then, of course, we move into 1938. You have the Anschluss. Austria is returned, comes into the German Reich. You have the Sudetenland is returned into the German Reich. You see a trend. And, of course, Poland's on notice. They know that they are occupying. Poland is occupying a large portion, almost one-third of former German territory. You know, West Prussia, the what they call the Polish Corridor, which is a silly name. Why we even use that term, the Polish Corridor? That was the German Corridor. That was the corridor that linked the former province of Pomerania with East Prussia, and it was actually the northern portion of West Prussia. They are occupying almost one third of former German territory with Germans in it, and they're seeing this trend that the Treaty of Versailles is being righted, and they have an opportunity to either engage in good faith diplomatic relations and negotiations to resolve it or not. And they decide to throw the dice and start playing a very dangerous game. They're playing they're trying to, you know, play on the Soviet end, and then of course they have this game going on with the Britain and the French, and of course the Britain and France are using them as a pawn. Because they have other issues. Bear in mind, London is dominated by international Jewish finance every bit as much as New York is. And since 1934, when Judea declares war on Germany, they're looking for a pretext to get the United States, Britain, and France, and Russia, hopefully, to crush Germany like they did between 1914 and 1918. They're trying to get that grand coalition back together. They got Britain and France on board with this, by the end of 38, early 39, they got Britain and France on board by guaranteeing, quote, Polish territory, Poland's territorial integrity. What's interesting is after, after the which they had declared after occupation of Bohemia and Moravia, they had issued this artificial guarantee of Polish territories. They knew, Deanna. They knew that was going to be an issue to be resolved. But interestingly, Germany never asked for the full return of all of the German territories that Poland was holding. They wanted Danzig and the corridor that had linked, that section of West Prussia that separated East Prussia from Pomerania. They were not. You can find nothing in the demands of Germany in the negotiations to say we also want Posen and the remainder of West Prussia back. There was no demands of altering those territories either. No demand whatsoever. No matter what some of the other agenda-driven historians will say. Now, obviously, once the war broke out, they took those as part of the being the winners, and they had every right to, and they had every right to demand that all of West Prussia be returned as part of the negotiations. But they did not make that demand. Their issue had to do with Danzig, and initially it had to do with Danzig, and their original proposal was the return of Danzig and a railway line and a mutual defense agreement. And Poland rejected that. Why would Poland reject that, given their fear of the Soviets? Poland was scared to death of the Soviets. That was the original, in just summary, the German proposal was Danzig, a firm link between Pomerania and East Prussia, and they would do a long-term mutual defense agreement. And of course, the Soviets didn't like that. Poland rejected that. That's fact. Because they were playing footsie with the French, they were playing footsie with the British. You had Franklin Roosevelt. Now let's not leave him out. Franklin Roosevelt was intriguing and was involved. Now what is Franklin Roosevelt, whose policies had failed? The United States was still deeply in the midst of depression, telling the Poles, hold out. You stand firm against the evil Nazis. Do not accept their proposals. Franklin Roosevelt is probably more to blame for the destruction of Western Christian civilization in Europe than Neville Chamberlain or Edward de Ladier and their artificial guarantees on Poland. Why? Because the international Jewish bankers had more of a stranglehold on him. And he was in agreement. He was one of them. Then probably their political stranglehold on London and Paris. It's absolutely atrocious that Roosevelt, sitting in Washington D.C. in a bankrupt nation, failed policies, was able to tell the Poles, to go to war over something that the Poles knew wasn't theirs. They knew Danzig did not belong to them. They had admitted that, hopefully one day the 3 or 4% of the Poles that lived in Danzig would return to Polish territory. In fact, the Poles to this day don't even like their own borders. They would like to have the borders, east of the Vistula that are part of Ukraine today. There's a large segment in Poland to this day that are, still would like border realignment. They would probably give the Germans back the Eastern German territories in exchange for the former Polish territories that are now in Ukraine. It's interesting. There's been Polish authors that have written about that as recently as 2 years ago, but that's another story. Anyway, Roosevelt was intriguing at the same time. Why? You have this Jew Morgenthau that's whispering in his ear, and Morgenthau was international Jewry's main man in the Roosevelt administration. Hyping him up to stir the pot. You got 70-year-old, Chamberlain issuing these guarantees that probably he did not want to really do. And let's fast forward a little bit.
Didn't they also have William C. Bullitt?
Well, William Bullitt was the hatchet man that was going around and was actually was carrying the water. And it was absolutely atrocious. The United States had no strategic interest in the German-Polish issue.
Right. All righty, we do need to take a 3-minute break. We will be right back. All righty, we are back. Today our guest is Rodney Martin. He is the director of Worldview Foundations. That website is wvfoundations.org. All right.
Okay.
We got a short segment and then go to the second hour.
I think it's important, and what my premise is had there not been the external interference into Polish politics, into Polish foreign policy, which was both whipped up internally by Jewish influences, and of course the external interference whipped up by Jewish influences in Washington, London, and Paris. The German situation between Poland and Berlin would have resolved itself. Danzig, Poland, I believe, and Germany would have signed some arrangements because they've been working on this since 1934. Poland clearly saw that what Germany was interested in. As a matter of fact, Hitler early on had suggested, "Hey, Poland, let's sign an agreement and to stave off, you know, the Soviet onslaught, you know, Bolshevism, you know, into Europe." And so, if Germany and Hitler was so anti-Polish as everybody talks about, why did they propose such, you know, an arrangement to stave off the Soviet designs on Europe? Germany had recognized that the Soviets had tried to invade and annex Poland in 1919. They had recognized that early on. So my premise is that if you take out the Jewish designed internal influences into the German-Polish negotiations, you know, that had started as early as 1934. The Polish issue between Germany and Poland over Danzig and the corridor, that would have resolved because Poland had seen the diplomatic successes and saw German determination to, one, achieve their diplomatic objectives. And Germany had always outlined what their objectives were clearly, and they never went beyond those. Anschluss, you know, bring home Austria, bring home the Sudetenland, and then, of course, the Polish corridor. And Germany had never made any demands on Poland for the remainder of West Prussia, and that did not go unnoticed either. The issue is the international, and we're going to talk about that in the second hour, and hopefully we'll get a lot of calls, the international system, this banking cabal, which still draws nations into war. You know, started whipping up this anti-German frenzy, using the media, getting these Polish goons, you know, that were, you know, led by Jewish commissars to go out and, you know, rape, rob, and pillage and murder the German minorities, you know, in the former West Prussian territories that were occupied by Poland. And they started the same playbook, Deanna, that we see to this day, the run-up to the Iraq War. What happened? The media played along. The media whipped up this sentiment. You know, Saddam Hussein is the new Hitler, and Saddam Hussein's going to invade the United States. I mean, they use the same playbook over and over and over, and people buy into it. You know, and it really had nothing to do with aggression.
It just amazes me that people still buy into it, and it is because of the historical changes that the educational apparatus have imposed, as well as the media. People are just kind of brain dead, I think. We do have to take our 60-second top of the hour break. We will be right back after station ID. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back. This is Deanna, and this is the second hour of Spincola Speaks. Our guest today is Rodney Martin. He is the director of Worldview Foundations. That website is wvfoundations.org. And we will take calls after the next break at 877-488-5350. You know, you brought up something very interesting about the similarities between the invasion of Iraq and what happened with Germany and Poland. And it is interesting that the United States, even after the horrific depression, which was, I believe, imposed by the Jews, that William C. Bullitt made a deal with the British because of the Johnson Act. The Johnson Act prevented Roosevelt from furnishing direct financial assistance. And so what they decided to do was to be able to furnish warplanes through Britain, and then in turn Britain would give Poland the planes. And and here they'd just gotten through, or were actually still in a depression, and yet we're spending money to do warfare.
Yeah, well, Deanna, Roosevelt was notorious for breaking the law. He ran stuff out of Quebec. He just ran it up to Canada and ran it at Quebec. You know, he broke the law all the time. And of course, you know, this almost this deity type status that some people hold him on is absolutely bogus, because he was itching to, for, you know, something to happen in Europe. He wanted to, get that war going. He wanted to get in something going on to bail him out at home. And of course, you know, with the Japanese situation, you know, he knew Pearl Harbor was going to happen. So what does it happen? He allows Pearl Harbor to, you know, stokes that going on, pokes a cane in the eye of the Japanese, gets them to attack Pearl Harbor, but he pulls aircraft carriers out first, you know, leaves the aged battleships there and gets a bunch of U.S. sailors killed in the process. And what is his priority? Instead of, you know, waging war with Japan, who quote unquote attacked us at his instigation, he makes Europe the priority. Why? Because the Jews want Europe. They want the Germans crushed yet again. Makes no sense. And you go, you know, it's not rocket science. It's not rocket science at all. And it goes back to, you know, 19, you know, 30, you know, the, towards the end of 1933, when, you know, worldwide Jewry declared war on National Socialist Germany, before National Socialist Germany had done anything. There had been no Nuremberg decrees in 1933. Nuremberg decrees came in 1935, you know, almost 2 years later, International Jewry had essentially been waging war on National Socialist Germany for 2 years before Germany reacted to them and said, you know what, we have an enemy alien group in our nation that has declared war on us. We guess we better do something about it, you know, 2 years later. Hello? I mean, you know, it's incredible. But getting back to this, again, I'm doing this contrast in this Polish situation and actually what the true aims were, because the true aims were economic. Dan, I think we need to wrap up the Polish thing and take some questions, because there's just so many lies and distortions about what happened. Moving into 1939, there was a concerted effort. Germany made some serious diplomatic proposals. Again, I'm going to reiterate, their proposal was to return Danzig, you know, to Germany. It was a German city in this League of Nations, you know, free city garbage, and to guarantee German access between Pomerania, Danzig, and East Prussia. Germany did not make claims on Posen and the rest of those. You know, they were not demanding all of the rest, greatly modifying the 1937 borders. And they were asking for guarantees on the safety of the German population. And of course, things have been fundamentally changing, because you had these tremendous atrocities. Again, like I said, we're being reported.
Absolutely. All righty, we're going to a break. We will be back in 3 minutes. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Rodney Martin. He is the director of Worldview Foundations. That website is wvfoundations.org. And you were talking about the Polish atrocities. And there is a book. It was written in 1940. It's called The Polish Atrocities Against the German Minority in Poland. And anybody that wants documentation about that can certainly email me. Or do you have that posted on your website?
Yes, I have it. I'm going to upload it probably today or this evening, or probably this evening. And actually, that is probably, that book has all of the links to the outside media, not German media, because if you were to say it was in the, posted in the German media, everyone will dismiss it. But it actually has the citations to the Paris media, to the London media, and some of the other media that was covering the atrocities and was saying, you know, this needs to be addressed. And actually, there was actually some notations in there. There was diplomatic communications between London and Paris to Warsaw saying, we're aware that this is happening. It hasn't been reported to us by Berlin. Our own attachés and ambassadors in Warsaw are making us aware that you are persecuting and engaging in it, almost quasi-genocide against the Germans in the former Prussian territories, and this needs to stop. And so I'm going to post that. It's in a PDF. It'll be a PDF file. Should be really simple to download, like the German White Book. And again, these are all original documents. And I can't stress enough, like for students like Emily, to use original documents, because the original documents, both German, even, you know, Soviet documents, because the, you know, Russia now is making some a lot of documents available. And, you know, it wasn't too terribly long ago, maybe 24 months ago, that Russian military archivists were basically had admitted that Stalin was going to invade Europe, and that Barbarossa was indeed a preemptive action. Now, it was announced, and then that was it. They never covered it anymore, and none of the agenda historians like Emily's teacher said anything. Nobody said, we've been wrong. They just let it be announced and then went on about their business. As a matter of fact, I don't remember a story on CNN, ABC, not even Fox News, none of them announcing that, hey, you know, Russia has announced that, yes, Stalin was going to invade Europe, because it would have contradicted the Jewish narrative. And heaven forbid, we can't do that. We cannot do that. You know, they begrudgingly just announced that the United States covered up Catan. I mean, they covered that up. They knew that the Soviets had massacred the Polish intellectuals and military leadership in their zone of occupied Poland. They knew it, and they covered it up. And, you know, we can cover that a little bit later, if we have time in the show, about the Soviet invasion of Poland in September of 39. But getting back, you know, we're in 1939, and things really heat up as far as diplomatic activity to resolve this, what they call the Polish corridor, which is really a silly term, because it was not ever a Polish corridor by any means. It was called that as a result of the Treaty of Versailles. Germany made numerous attempts. They made proposal after proposal after proposal, but then the atrocities happened. And I believe that happened for a reason, Deanna. Essentially, you had Jewish commissars out taking Polish nationals after the media in Poland, the Jewish media in Poland, had whipped up a frenzy and started engaging in this essentially genocide against the German minority. And what they're doing is they're creating a pretext for war, because, you know, concurrently you have Neville Chamberlain issuing this stupid guarantee, and it's been documented that Adolf Hitler's comment was, you know, what business is it, what interest is it of London's and Paris's of this issue we have going on with Poland? And, you know, so we take action, you know, they're going to come to the table, and they're going to, you know, we're going to go in, we're going to take Danzig, we're going to take that, and, you know, they're going to ultimately back down, we're going to work out an arrangement like we did at Munich, and it's going to be it. And, you know, his position was, his mindset was, it's been documented by people that were around him, was, what business is it of theirs? What's their interest in that? And, of course, you know, I'm not sure he knew at the time that Franklin Roosevelt was the one that was actually pushing this. He was pushing Chamberlain. He was pushing him. It was Franklin Roosevelt. He was the one with Morgenthau, which, you know, I can't stress this enough. Chamberlain was actually, he was a man of 70 years old, had stomach cancer, and he was agonizing over this. As a matter of fact, on August 28th, which was several days before war had even started, the British High Command came to him and was pestering him to have a meeting to sign war plans. They were already getting ready for war. And the British military high command had been coordinating, had been consulting with the United States, with the War Department. What business is it of the United States? What's going on in the Polish situation? What business it is of England? What goes on between a Polish dispute with Germany over German territory, over Germans? It's basically German citizens. It's dumbfounding, but we know what it is. We're going to talk about it right now. It's economics. The National Socialists come to power, and we talked about the National Socialist Economic Plan in prior shows. They came to power, and they implemented that plan. They were well-disciplined. They had the will of the people, and I just did a oral history with a gentleman by the name of Donkwart Kohler. and it's posted on my website. And now it's interesting. He's kind of a different type of interview because he remains a German citizen. And I didn't know that until I spent about 6 hours with him, and then we did about a 2.5 hour interview. And so he is subject to extradition. The Germans could listen to what he says and what he doesn't say and such, and they could say, we're going to extradite you, and, we're going to have some words with him. So anyway, but what's interesting, he went ahead and did the interview, but he made some very interesting comments. He said, one, that Weimar was an abject failure. Everybody was unemployed. The country was destitute. The morale was, there was no national pride. He said the National Socialists came to power, and it was almost, almost immediately things began to improve. The national pride improved. He said the economy just turned around. They put people back to work. They began producing again. If you just listen to that oral history, he was there. He lived just south of Stuttgart. In fact, I'm going to do an oral history next week with the German lady who lived in Stuttgart as well. And but anyway, getting back to Mr. Kohler, he basically was very, very descriptive. He talked about the tremendous turnaround of the German economy and how fast it happened. By 1936, Germany was economically self-sufficient. When I say, there's a difference between self-sufficient and a world power. And the self-sufficiency is what scared the world powers, especially international Jewry and the international banking cartel. And when I say international banking cartel, I put them on the same plane as a drug cartel, because they're both equally corrosive. They both enslave. Drugs enslave people every bit as much as a bank enslaves people. And Germany got rid of them. They proved that an economic system could be developed where you did not need massive amounts of usury. You did not have to enslave yourselves to the middleman. They did that, and by 1936, at least, definitely by 1937, they were actually emerging as a world power as well. The two together, an economically self-sufficient nation emerging as a world power, that sent shock waves across the Atlantic, through Paris, through London, and on into Washington, D.C. You have Franklin Delano Roosevelt sitting over there with the Jews whispering in his ear, got to do something about this. Germany's back. Their people are working in London. They're working in Paris. And of course, their frontline troops are the French army, backed up always by a British expeditionary force. And of course, they always bring, their big guerrilla, the Americans, over to, finish the task after they worked on it for about two, three years. So, they started on this early. They started on this in 1934. When that was published, Judea declares war on Germany. That was the boycott. It started then. The plans were in the works. We have to do something about this. They definitely started ratcheting up in 1937 and 1938, and of course the artificial guarantee on Poland. Okay, go back. Like I said earlier in the first hour, Poland and Germany were working this issue out. Germany was obtaining its territorial goals, the goals that it had outlined for its foreign policy, peacefully through diplomatic ways. And I like to use repetition because it's important, because people have been so hammered and hammered with this stuff about Germany was an aggressor nation and used aggression and war to achieve its aims. Really? Okay, let's recap. Germany, Austria was incorporated back into Germany by peaceful means and by a plebiscite in which 98% of Austrians voted for Anschluss. As a matter of fact, the western areas of Germany, the Ruhr and the Saar, they voted in a plebiscite as well to return. It was France wanted, had been trying to get those, since, the Treaty of Versailles. They returned to Germany. The Sudetenland, that was rightfully done by an international treaty. The Bohemia and Moravia, that was done. The Czechs invited German occupation. That was done peacefully, regardless. And the Slovaks wanted independence, which they got. There was never a massive German occupation in Slovakia, and economically they thrived in the new National Socialist Europe. Germany worked since 1934 on the Polish issues, and they would have. And again, it's my position that without the Jewish interference in the internal affairs between those two governments, and them taking advantage of the after the death of Podolsky, they would have worked that out, particularly looking at the diplomatic successes that Germany had had, you know, prior to 1938, prior to 1939. But you had a Weimar situation that developed from 1935, 36 on in Poland, and boy, did the external forces take control.
Exactly. All righty, we're going to a break. We will be back, and we do invite your phone calls, and you can call in to 877-488-5350. Be right back. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Rodney Martin. He is the director of Worldview Foundations. That website is wvfoundations.org, and it looks like we do have some callers lining up. So you want to finish your some comments before we take calls?
There was a comment in the chat room about FDR being poisoned. I wanted to comment on that. Several years back, I saw an interview by Dr. Howard Bruin, who was FDR's cardiologist. He was brought in late 44 by FDR's doctors because they realized he was sick. And Bruin, that was probably one of the only interviews that Dr. Bruin had given, and he'd indicated FDR had congestive heart failure. FDR was, you know, drank and smoked. And, you know, he essentially, when you have congestive heart failure, everything else goes, and he essentially just wasted away like the evil, you know, piece of evil that he was. And so it couldn't have happened to a, you know, to a nicer, to a better person. So, I don't believe he was poisoned. You know, he was philandering around, was having his picture taken by his, you know, with his mistress, and was drinking and smoking, and, you know, ended up with a cerebral hemorrhage. I'm not sure that he was poisoned. I do believe that Stalin was poisoned by the Jew Beria. And I'm not sure that the FDR was. I think FDR just was ended up dying as a result of his unhealthy living. And you know, so what? It's just too bad it didn't happen much sooner to prevent the horrible policies and destruction. Because FDR is the single person most responsible for the destruction of Western Christian civilization, in Europe, which spread across the Atlantic to the United States. He destroyed Europe, and he destroyed this country as a result of his policies and having the United States on the wrong side of history.
Right. Yeah, he was an evil guy. I guess he died in the arms of his mistress, too.
Yes. Yes. Yes, he
did. Alrighty. Should we take some phone calls?
All right.
Let's take Buddy from Boston. Buddy, welcome to the program.
Yes, good afternoon, and thank you very much. I had a question for your guest. His familiarity with the subject that I found on the internet called the Comintern Pact, why such diverse areas as Japan and Italy signed a pact with Germany. Are you familiar with that name?
Yes, yes.
Okay, I'll get off the phone. Thank you, Deanna.
Yes, it was. They also called it, if I remember correctly, they also referred to it as the Pact of Steel. And in fact, there were some efforts to even expand that. But, you know, as relating to what we're talking about now, and I think I mentioned it earlier in the show, as early as 1934, late 1934, Hitler had approached Poland about signing a much broader agreement aimed to keeping the Soviets in check and to keep them from coming into Europe. And by that time, you know, because Podolsky had died in 35 from liver cancer, and by that time, Poland was, you know, the Jewish forces were already beginning to turn Poland into a mini Weimar, and it was destabilizing. Just nothing was happening, and Podolsky on his deathbed was essentially trying to keep things kind of neutral. He was deathly fearful of the Soviets. He had a desire to improve relations with England, as did Hitler. You know, Hitler, you know, the whole time he was waging war, you know, was trying to improve relations with England. So, yeah, I am familiar with that pact. And interestingly, I have some criticism of that pact because I don't believe Japan lived up to its all of the obligations under that pact.
All righty, let's take Richard in Washington. Richard, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. I always enjoy Roddy's factual presentations of true history. I wondered, I think I suggested this before, if he'd ever gotten to Ominous Parallels by Leonard Peikoff.
I have not, but I have ordered it.
Excellent, excellent. My belief is if you don't learn from history, you repeat it. And as you've pointed out, we have a small focused tribe that is imposing their worldwide view and objectives on us herd mentality types. Those two trends seem to be depopulation and corporate feudalism, transferring wealth to their purses versus ours. Since you continually repeat this point of view from the history of Germany, what's the solution?
Well, let me comment and then I'll tell you what the solution is. You just hit what World War II was about, transferring wealth. And let's stop and talk about it, and then I'll talk about what my opinion is, and that could be get you a cup of coffee and it could not. World War II was about the transfer of wealth. The National Socialist system, particularly the economic system, stopped dead in the tracks the transfer of wealth for doing nothing. That's what it did. National Socialist economic policy, and that's why Worldview Foundations is in the we're doing publishing projects as well, publishing the economic publications that have been essentially buried, and we're returning those, we're having those translated. We have one that's coming out very shortly, it's already done, and then we have two more in the works. And that's why that is so important, so people can see exactly what the economic proposals and theory was and why they were so successful. But what World War II was about was the transfer of wealth. The international banking cartels, which are basically Jew-driven, wanted to continue this transfer of wealth, essentially this middleman cartel type of situation, which I equate to drug cartels. You know, what does a drug cartel do? What does a crack dealer does? Keeps you coming back. Keeps you coming back, and they do nothing. And that is what this was about. Germany was going to stop that and end that. And so they all got together. Why would capitalism and communism all get on the same side at some point?
Exactly. All right, we do have to take a break. We will be right back after a word from our sponsors. Welcome back. This is Deanna, and our guest today is Rodney Martin, the director of Worldview Foundations. That website is wvfoundations.org. And anyway, you were responding to Richard's question.
Yeah, I think I covered this. I wanted to cover the wealth transfer because he hit it in a nutshell. That's what World War II was about. National Socialism, National Socialist economic policy was going to end the wealth transfer. You know, that had been so harmful and devastating to nations and nation states, which still is. Look at Greece, look at Italy, look at Spain, look at this concept of bailouts, which now, you know, the European Union is saying it's Germany's job because it's the healthiest state, you know, even being a vassal state and having been robbed of more of its territory after World War II, is still the most powerful economic country in Europe, you know, the German ingenuity. There's this institutional and cultural hatred of Germans because of their ingenuity and you know, just who and what they are. But besides that, Germany ended this wealth transfer, you know, for doing nothing but brokering goods and services, for, you know, ending wealth for no work. They ended that, and that was going to, you know, Washington and London and Paris, they were going to end that. But it derived from Washington. Make no mistake about it, the war in Europe came about by the political intrigue of Franklin Roosevelt. Now, what can we do about it? First thing, I think, is we have to make sure that we take our children back and that we're actively involved in their education. If the school that they're in is so horrendous that, you know, they have the teachers like Emily's teacher, then parents are going to have to homeschool their kids. You know, make no mistake about it, make it happen. Do not surrender your children. The second thing is stop the Jew speak. Do not take your language and words back. Don't say Holocaust. Don't say Holocaust survivor. They were inmates. A lot of them were in there for crimes, for Pete's sake. Don't concede your language and your terminology. Don't talk their language. Don't concede anything. If you know it's not true, don't concede it. Those are the first two big things that you can start to do. And then three, don't support anything or anyone that doesn't conform to your values and ideals. You know, this business saying, well, we have to compromise. Well, the road to surrender goes through compromise.
Yes, indeed. And of course, I think it's also the things that you're doing, the interviews that you're doing, all of the things that you're making available via your website. Those are all very supportive and things that we need to spread around. And I think it's also important that we listen to radio programs that don't promote garbage and support the government's version of World War II.
Well, also, let me respond to something because I think I'm getting corrected about my use of Holocaust. And in the chat room, Uncle Rick says Dresden was a Holocaust. Dresden was a war crime and Dresden was genocide. You could say Dresden was a Holocaust. I don't like to use the word Holocaust because that opens up a debate for Jews to say, well, what happened to us? No, Dresden was clearly was targeting a cultural city that had not been touched all during the war. It was genocide and it was a war crime. They want to get into a debate on war crimes, then we can talk about war crimes. And I can tell you there was far more actions that could be classified as war crimes done by the British, Americans, and even by French in 1944-45, but definitely by the Soviets, than were ever done, by the Germans. If you look at the German occupations of Europe between 1939 through 1944 and 45, because there were still nations, entire nations of the German occupation until the end of the war, compare that with the Allied occupations and from World War II forward, I can tell you the German occupations were benevolent, they were humane, and even citizens in those occupied territories will tell you, look at the British citizens who were on the Channel Islands, who were occupied until the end of World War II. They will tell you that the German occupation forces were benevolent, they were kind, they were respectful, and they were professional. So, that's their testimony. I have a videotape of British citizens who lived on the Channel Islands during the war, and that's their statements. It doesn't fit into the traditional narrative, but it is what it is, isn't it?
Right.
Getting back, unless we have another caller.
We do. Richard, did you have another comment?
Well, I just wanted to say that those were excellent solutions, but it seems to me that basically the transfer of wealth has taken place. The corporate feudalism is in place pretty much worldwide, except for Iran. They're now moving very seriously to depopulation. They're polluting the biosphere to take us all down. And I'd hope Rodney would listen to our hour that we did a couple of days ago, because I figure that's the only real solution. We have to get the lone wolves or the lone small tribes getting healthy so that they can really take over when the biosphere is brought down.
Oh, I agree with you. I agree with you on that. I do agree with you on that. But also the key also to beginning, any sort of struggle is to actually get your facts and to be educated and be able to engage. But I also agree with you there as well. You have to be healthy as well. And there is a concerted effort to kill us off.
Exactly. I wait to hear the other callers.
All righty. Thanks, Richard. All righty. Let's take Jeff in Vermont. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. Great show, Deanna, once again. I've been doing research on World War II for a while, and I wasn't, just like everybody else, swallowed the big lie of how bad, Hitler was and National Socialism was. And I think in the truth movement, that's the last thing people actually wake up to, and that in race and, being racially conscious. And another thing is that, now that I know the truth about the NSDAP and everything, there's a concerted effort online, still, I just read this article with Henry Mackow, and I want you to address this because he's been promoting this a lot, and he's Jewish too, but Hitler in his nuclear ambitions, I guess they found barrels and barrels of depleted uranium in a salt mine. I think it was in probably eastern Germany. Probably, the Russians probably put it in there afterwards. But he's saying that Hitler detonated a nuclear weapon. And he has this proof. He made this YouTube video on where he had these scientists come over and do an analyze of the soil and uranium and all this stuff, and I know it's a lie, but what's your opinion on Hitler and the NSD having the technology to have a nuclear weapon? And I don't know if you've ever, I know it's a hoax and it's a bunch of BS, but I was just wondering what's your opinion on it, if they have the technology, if they're pursuing that avenue, get some clarity and truth to this.
Okay, well, let me comment on a couple of things you said. When people say Hitler and the NSDAP had a nuclear weapon, let's clarify a couple of things. The NSDAP was the political party. Keep in mind, there's the political party, there is the state, the government, the army, and all that. So I think those of us in the truth movement needs to be real careful not to fall into what I say the Jews speak and buy into this. Oh, it's Hitler and the Nazis. It was the German government. Hitler was the head of state of the German government. So the German nuclear program fell under the German government. It was led by German scientists. It was a function of the German government. They were developing a nuclear program just like the Americans were doing out in Los Alamos or White Sands, New Mexico. It wasn't part of the, you know, the NSDAP was the political party that, was gauging public sentiment. The political party did things that political parties did. And so I think it's really, we need to really be careful when we talk about, Hitler and the NSDAP had, did this, and Hitler and the NSDAP, there was the NSDAP as the political party within Germany, then there was the state, the government doing things, and et cetera. So we need to be real careful about our language and our terminology, and we make sure that we get things factually and accurate. Now, as to the nuclear program, yes, Germany had a nuclear program. And I think they were further advanced than what people are led to believe. Whether they ever detonated a device, I've not seen evidence that they did. I frankly wish that they had gotten one completed and at least would have waved it around and told the Red Army, stop, or Moscow is going to glow, and told the Western Allies, stop, or Paris is going to glow, because they would have, and it would have saved Western Christian civilization. I frankly am of the opinion that they should have loaded warheads full of Tabun gas and dropped it on the Red Army, given what the Red Army was doing in Eastern Europe and what the atrocities they were doing in Eastern Europe. And that's a radical thing for someone to say, but it would have stopped the Red Army onslaught into Europe. And so do I have any evidence that the Germans detonated and tested a nuclear weapon? No, I don't. I do believe they were further along in developing, but the clock ran out. The Wehrmacht just couldn't hold back two fronts. They couldn't hold back the onslaught of in the West and in the East, and they just ran out of time, material, and space to keep the program going. And then, of course, you had traitors and spies and covert actions that were leading raids on their testing facilities. So that's my take on the nuclear capabilities and what was happening in the closing days of the war.
All right, I guess I got to work on my juice speak. I guess that's funny more.
No. And I meant that to be constructive. I hope you understand that. I meant that to be constructive.
No pun intended. That's all good.
I still catch myself every once in a while, and I'm having to. But keep in mind, this has been going on for 60 years. People are taught or indoctrinated, or it's used every day on the boob tube and books and in the newspaper and such. And you just got to find. You just got to. We have to train ourselves to say, that's hogwash. That's not proper terminology. They're trying to control us subliminally by retooling our language.
Yeah, it's really hard.
If I may comment, you made another comment too about the truth movement, about wanting to not addressing race and National Socialism as the very last. That is something else that has to be addressed as well, because I can tell you that the National Socialist Germany was the first true nationalist state that was successful. Has there ever been one since? Was there ever really one before? Well, probably there was one states, because nationalism was, there was nothing wrong with nationalism before, and there's nothing wrong with nationalism now. But National Socialist Germany was the first nation to actually cast out, the Weimar model, where multiculturalism was being force-fed into the culture and the arts, into the society, into the social norms. It actually was one where nationalism made a resurgence, race made a resurgence, and it was successful, and you look at the people fought to the bitter end in 1945 to preserve it, and you look at the interviews that I have done today, 60, 70 years later, people in their 80s, and some of them in their 90s, still defend it. They consider it some of the best days and years of their lives. And so I think it is a big mistake and a disgrace for so-called people in the truth movement to shy away from National Socialism and to shy away from defending the policies of National Socialism and Hitler. They need to say, hey, all of this garbage that's said about it is absolutely factless. It has no merit. And we need to approach that like we do all the other lies and distortions and boondoggles.
And another thing I'd like you to address, you probably know more about this issue than me, is how diverse the Waffen SS was with, you know, they had people joining to fight communism and to fight the Britons. I mean, they were the most diverse army on the face of the earth prior to World War II and since World War II. You know, you had the Muslims, you had the Cossacks, you had everybody joining in, and Hitler wasn't prejudiced. You know, I mean, he believed in a national socialist Germany and probably a national socialist state for kind of all races, you know.
Well,
and just the whole diversity of his army, I think, was kind of amazing too. I mean, I don't think he went around and put other races down and said the Germans were the best ever to ever walk the face of the earth.
Well, sure. Let me stop you right there, because sure, Hitler had pride in the German race. There's no doubt about that. His statements say that. But you know, he did not actually, you know, contrary to the traditional narrative, say I'm going to exterminate everybody else. He did believe in the value of nation states, and the Waffen-SS is a good model. That was the first truly successful multinational force. Now, some people like to argue with me and say, what about the French Foreign Legion? Well, that's really not applicable, because if you look at the Waffen-SS, yes, they wore the German Waffen-SS uniform with the runes on them, but they also had an arm patch of their member nation. It was a multinational force. It was not, you know, it was a truly multinational force. And if it was so bad, you know, you're looking at, you know, the UN force today, where you have a UN uniform, but every member is, you know, they still wear the patch of their member nation. It's pretty close to the Waffen-SS model. You had British members of the British members of the Waffen-SS. You had Danish members of the Waffen-SS. Leon de Grel was a prime example, a decorated hero on the Eastern Front, wounded several times on the Eastern Front. They were all united. All of these nations were all united in their determination to beat back Bolshevism, communism, and it was truly a successful model of bringing together a true multinational force, and that's a prime example. And that probably would have been a model. We talked in our last program about the post-war goals of Europe. You would have seen a tremendous expansion probably had Germany succeeded in the war of a retooled Waffen-SS to defend the new Europa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
all righty.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jeff. All right, let's take Werner in New Brunswick.
Good evening. Good morning. I just cut in lately towards the end of your show, and here I just want to mention something. What I understand about the Waffen-SS, there were about 1,000 members. A million members, and 600,000 were foreign nationals from the Eastern European countries to Western European countries. All those people that were standing up against the prevalent threat of the communist takeover, ultimately, of all the world. Now, I look at it, for example, you know, you can have strong nation states. It's like a global village. But every villager doesn't have to look into their neighbors and go into their kitchen and tell them what to cook in their kitchen. You know, nations can live peacefully together without interfering in all their affairs, you know, at a national level. Mm-hmm. This is where basic fairness comes in. But because the people in the Western countries, the Western allies especially, they have been indoctrinated now for about 100 years with all those lies, and by the controlled media. They have bought, most of the people, they have bought everything, hook, line, and sinker, the propaganda. And they've been drinking the propaganda Kool-Aid. And it is hard to undo all the damage that has been done.
Mm-hmm. A couple of things that Werner had commented on, Deanna. The oral history interviews that I've done. Oh, we'll pick it up on the other end.
Whoops. Yep. All right. We'll be right back. We've got a break. Welcome back. This is Deanna. Our guest today has been Rodney Martin. He is the director of Worldview Foundations. His website is wvfoundations.org. Please go there and listen to some of those wonderful, wonderful interviews. Fabulous.
Deanna, I wanted to cover a couple of things. It's really interesting. The Waffen-SS was only about 40, in some cases 35% German. They defended, they were one of the last units to be in the Battle of Berlin. The last unit to actually surrender in the Battle of Berlin was a Waffen-SS unit, and it was a French division, the Charlemagne, it was a Charlemagne, a unit of the Charlemagne division, which is kind of interesting. Going in, when all diplomacy had failed, and of course that was a result, I believe, of all of the intrigue into internal affairs driven by international Jewry, driven through Washington, D.C., Hitler's directive, I always like to end the show on these original documents. Hitler's directive for beginning war in Poland only mentioned Poland in three lines. The rest of it were all directives telling the Wehrmacht to be restrained, not to do anything in the West, because there was no belief that there would be a wider war, that this would be constrained only to Poland and things would work themselves out. But it basically said, the opening lines was, since the situation on Germany's eastern frontier has become intolerable and all political possibilities of peaceful settlement have been exhausted. That's the opening line. And then it basically gives two more lines about the operations in Poland. The whole rest of it, which is about 10 paragraphs, tells the army to be restrained and to hold their positions on the western frontier of Germany and to take no offensive actions into the West. There was no belief in Germany in 1939 that there would be a major world war or a major war as a result of the Polish action. Nobody that I have interviewed, Mr. Donkwart Kohler, who I just interviewed a week ago, said nobody believed, reading in the media, in the news reports in Germany at the time, that this was meant to be just a regional action to resolve the Danzig issue. As a matter of fact, I'll go a step further. There was no real hardcore anti-Western propaganda, anti-Western editorials in the German media. Nobody that I've interviewed remembers anti-British, anti-French sentiment being published or whipped up in the German media at the time. What they do remember is reading about the atrocities against the German minority in Poland and the fact that Germany was trying to resolve diplomatically all of the issues regarding the so-called, and again, it's an artificial term, the so-called Polish corridor, and to reunite Danzig with Germany and to secure access from Pomerania to Danzig and into East Prussia. All that was reported. There was not this whipping up of public sentiment, against the West, against the Western nations to ready them for war. As a matter of fact, it was quite. Germany had actually postponed military action a week prior. And, of course, you have the signing of the non-aggression pact with the Soviet Union. And so, so dedicated was the international cartels to driving a war with Germany that they still decided to go to war when the Germany actually took military action. But what did they do? This is an interesting dynamic which remains unchallenged. They only went to war with Germany. They guaranteed Polish borders against Germany only, not against the Soviet Union, who also invaded Poland.
Yes, indeed. That tells you a lot. Well, thank you so much for being on the program today, and you'll be back next week.
Back next week. Thank you, Deanna.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye, listeners. Have a great weekend. Talk to you on Monday.